Welcome to Timebender Talks, the ultimate destination for professional photographers. This weekly podcast is hosted by Peggy MacArthur, a certified professional photographer with over 30 years' experience and the creator of the Headshot Strategist Certification Program. Peggy interviews a diverse range of experts in business, branding, marketing, networking, and photography. So whether you've been doing this for years or you're just starting out, we've got you covered. Oh, and don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you don't miss out on our latest episodes filled with tips, insights, and lots of fun.
I am so excited to have Ethan with us today, and not just because he sent me a t-shirt. And for those of you listening to the podcast and not watching the video version, it is an orange t-shirt that says Science AF, and then it says Applied Brand Science. And okay, drum roll, everyone. Chocolate. He sent me chocolate. So Ethan is now my best friend. And that's all it takes, chocolate. There is a story as to why he sent me the chocolate. We won't get into all of that now. It's not because I like bribed him and guilted him. He did it because he wanted to be nice, I'm sure. But thank you either way for the chocolate, Ethan.
You're welcome. The bribing and the guilting may have had something to do with it.
I know. I have been told I'm really good at that. And clearly I am, because not only did I get a chocolate, I also got a t-shirt. So I feel very, very effective in my branding and marketing.
Well, I almost never show up to a meeting without chocolate. So I figured, even though you're three states or four states away, I should still be true to my word.
I really appreciate you. Like, seriously, like, anybody that knows me knows that dark chocolate, and this even has sea salt on it, so bonus points. But dark chocolate is definitely the way to my heart. So I had another guest send me whiskey, which is a pretty far up there on this too. I didn't know people would send me gifts if I had them on my podcast, but now I'm just throwing that out there. Like, hey, you know,
the universe will respond.
Right? Whiskey and chocolate, we're good.
Yeah.
Ethan, we should probably get started. This month, our topic is awareness. And of course, you are here to talk about branding. Now, I want to tell people a little bit about the first time that I heard you speak. A mutual friend of ours sent me a YouTube link, and I didn't know that this was somebody that she actually knew in real life. Like, I just thought, hey, this is really cool. You should listen to this YouTube. And I listened to it. And then I listened to it again. And it wasn't like a 10-minute thing. It was like, I don't know, 40 minutes, an hour. It was a sizable amount of my day. And I listened to it again with notes. And I was like, oh my God, this guy is amazing. How am I going to track him down and convince him to be on my podcast? And I went to my LinkedIn and I put in your name, and we were already connected. And I was like, oh, I get it. Like, this is like somebody we know in real life. Anyway, thus the guilt started with the chocolate, and here we are today. So science, tell us, should I call you Dr. Decker, or is Ethan all right?
You can call me Dr. Decker, but I have to get my pager and put it on so that you can also page me when there's a branding emergency, I guess.
Oh, that's really good. That's actually really good. And don't ever make that offer to me that I can page you when I have an emergency about branding.
Right. No, you'll be paging me for chocolate is what you'll be paging me for.
Exactly. Hey, I'm not thinking really clear. I think chocolate would help me in this branding problem that I have. But seriously, I want you to introduce yourself. Tell us where you are on your journey, how you kind of got there. And I mean, this is only a 45-minute podcast. So, you know, sum it up, you know, the Cliff Notes version.
Sure. I was born in Philadelphia. No, I'm just kidding. I am currently president and founder of Applied Brand Science, which is a consultancy and training company that helps marketing leaders learn and apply the science of branding. It turns out there is a science to it. There are lots of charlatans still. Snake oil has not gone away. It's still a thing. But if you dig a little deeper, there are scientific laws and principles, and they tell you how marketing really works, how shoppers really shop, and how advertising really works. I find that a lot of the time, there are great ideas people have in marketing and advertising, and they die not because they're bad ideas, but because people literally just disagree about how marketing and advertising even work. On the other hand, there are lots of really crap ideas in marketing and advertising that thrive, again, because people don't understand the science of it. So the science is important. However, what I've developed is what I call the laws and levers approach. The laws are indeed scientific laws. They apply to all the brands. But the levers are things that can work sometimes for some brands in some situations. And it's maddening because you can't always predict whether the levers will work or which levers to pull. The metaphor for putting these two together is, I guess you could say it, building a house or an airplane. You need to know the laws of physics for these things to stay upright or float in space or whatever they're supposed to do, withstand earthquakes. But you need an architect or a designer to decide, well, what is it going to feel like? What is it going to look like? Do you want to build a fighter jet or do you want to build a passenger plane or a blimp? And in the metaphor of the home, do you want it to feel like the kitchen flows into the backyard? Or do you want it to feel like it's nestled in with the Gothic architecture nearby? And that is not necessarily a science. That's an art. And it's a maddening, maddening art because it's really complex and hard.
I think that is the thing that no one else is talking about, that there are laws and principles and there is an art to it. They're not and or. They're not or this or that. They're and this and that. Things go hand in hand. And too many times, I think when we talk about branding and marketing, we think about like, how cool is your logo? What colors are you using? And there's definitely science behind colors and the reasoning, you know, how that affects us psychologically and all those things. But having a pretty logo isn't necessarily going to mean that your brand stands out, because a logo and a brand, they're, you know, are they the same? Absolutely not. You know, right. You can't, you know, you can have, you know, we can go on and on forever about this, but and I may be getting ahead of myself. And if I am, say, Peggy, I'm not there yet, but you
know, it's your show, Peggy.
I know your lane, Peggy. You're just supposed to ask questions. I'm actually doing the show. I got it. In this YouTube that I watched, you gave the analogy about toilet paper, buying toilet paper, that literally blew my mind. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. The YouTube you're referring to, I think, is a talk I gave recently at South by Southwest on an intro to the laws and levers of brand science. And I've really stuck to the toilet paper metaphor, so to speak, because it's a visceral, intuitive way to understand one of the fundamental ways that shoppers shop and consumers think. And we often forget this when we become marketers and we believe that we can educate people and that they think about our brand as much as we think about our brand. Well, the metaphor I use is, first of all, can you even remember the logos and the images on each pack? Like, what's the one with the bears versus what's the one with the baby? And is the baby an angel? Does it have wings or is it just a baby? And we can barely get that far into our thinking unless we're really into toilet paper. And then we know that the bears are Charmin. We even know the difference between the blue and the red bear. One's strong and one's soft. I don't know which is which. And you remember where the baby has wings and that it's angel soft, etc. But for most people, all they can be is like, well, okay, I know, I think I get the one with the bears. Yeah, that's the one I get. And that's what they get. And what they don't do is what I call toilet paper math. And that's when you try and figure out what's the price of a ply. Because you've got one ply or two ply. You've got 4.2 inches squared, which is 17.635 inches, which is different in metric because it's centimeters squared. And then you have to find out how many sheets per roll, how many regular rolls, and if it's a jumbo roll pack, how many regular rolls equal a jumbo roll? And then if it's on sale, you got to redo all your math. No one's got time for toilet paper math. No one does. And well, actually, in the crowd at South by Southwest, there was one person that actually did the toilet paper math, but that was out of 500 people. So it's a very small percentage who are going to do the math on toilet paper. And that's something that we should probably kind of think a lot about because it's an intimate product. I mean, we get really close to our toilet paper and we use it every single day. So if we're not willing to do the toilet paper math, what would make a marketer think that someone's going to do any kind of logical analysis of motor oil or olive oil or milk chocolate or whiskey or t-shirts? You know, it's just that we just don't have the time. We don't want to do the math. So that's the metaphor. And the law is that we are mental misers. Our job is not to analyze things and come up with logical conclusions. Our job is to think as little as possible and then get on with our lives. And if you change the way your starting point in how you assume your shoppers shop, you have a radically different approach to marketing, right? If you assume people are going to do a logical, rational analysis, then you do all these things which lead you to basically be advertising to computers who are going to do the toilet paper math. But if you assume that people are mental misers and that they ain't got time for toilet paper math, and they're going to think the least amount possible when they make even big decisions, not just toilet paper, but cars, really big stuff, colleges, then you're going to radically change how you do your marketing.
And I've been guilty of that, like showing them why I'm a good deal, like giving them the photography math. You get X amount of images at X amount of time, and it's only going to cost you X amount of, you know, oh, you don't want to go to that guy over there because he's only going to give you this amount of time. And people don't care.
Right. Or they only care a little bit. And they only care enough to try and squint and maybe figure it out. And so, for instance, one way you can figure out which toilet paper is the best is which one's the most expensive. Right there, that's a shortcut. And that's also a fundamental law of how shoppers shop, which is a corollary, you could say, or an outgrowth of the fact that we are mental misers. We have lazy brains. We take shortcuts. So if there's a hard question, like which toilet paper is indeed the best value? That's not a super hard question, but okay, it's which toilet paper is the best value? We take a shortcut and we ask ourselves, well, which one is good enough and looks like it's in the middle? Or which one doesn't seem like it's $40 for a single roll? Or which one did my friend Peggy tell me was the best one from Consumer Reports? So we take shortcuts, and that's how we do a lot of our shopping and a lot of our decision making. And that includes for things like photography or consultants or air conditioning units. We don't really do the math. You're right. By the way, Peggy, I've not heard anyone use the math in their own category yet. I love that.
Well, and I think the other thing that you mentioned, and this doesn't necessarily, I think, I don't know, maybe it is branding. It probably is now that I think about it. But you were like, hey, the best one is the most expensive one. And as photographers, a lot of us have a hard time pricing, you know, upping our prices and pricing adequately enough that we can live doing what we do. And every single time I have upped my prices, every single time it has come with nail biting, anxiety, sleepless nights. Oh my God, I'm going to lose all my clients. This is my last day in business because I'm going to up my prices and I'm going to lose everyone. And every single time what has happened is I have maybe lost a couple, you know, a couple people that were just there for that price point, but I have doubled or tripled with new clients every time. Obviously I don't just like willy nilly, like every five weeks up my prices, but when it is time, like, hey, it's been a while since I've changed prices. And I think that's, there was a time where my prices were so low that people thought, oh, you know, I like what she's doing, but she's so cheap. She's probably not really that good. I don't know what the catch is, but there's something that's not right. And that is actually, you know, a law. We think that is automatically what our brain goes to. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I think we don't talk about that enough either, is just, and it's really understanding how people think and reason. And a quick assumption is, if it's expensive, it's good. If it's cheap, it's bad. And that doesn't take any research. It's a no thought conclusion. No research. Correct. Conclusion.
It's an easy shortcut.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's bad, even if it's wrong. It's also a bit of an optical illusion, or I sometimes call them cognitive illusions. We all know optical illusions, where you hold two things up and they're actually the same size, but they look like they're different size. But no matter how hard you try to break through, you can't see them as different size, because it's an optical illusion, even though you know,
right?
You go back and forth and back and forth. That same level of trickery happens with pricing. Absolutely. So if you see a $200 t-shirt and it's on sale for $70, you think that's an amazing value and you can't help but believe it must be high quality because it was originally $200. It just, it works on us in these very subconscious, quick, intuitive ways. And it's very hard to not see the illusion, to say, oh, that's just marketing. That's not really a $200 t-shirt. It's just worth, you know, $40. And you're right. The fundamental shortcut is, if it's higher priced, it must be better quality.
And I did that just recently. I was looking at a portable monitor and I had done the research. I was like, this is the best monitor in my price range. This is awesome. And so I went to see if it was also on Amazon, because, you know, and then when I did that, Amazon's like, oh, what about this? What about this? And then there was one that was like double the price as mine, but it was on sale. And I was like, oh, I bet that's even better. And I started to click on it. And then I was like, you did a lot of research to figure out what you wanted, Peggy.
Like, now you're going to throw it all out because,
you know, as simple as looking at reviews, I almost didn't. I almost just like went, oh, this is clearly better than the thing that I actually reviewed and actually looked at, you know, information. How long does the battery last? All of these things, like, this one's right. Probably better. And it almost got me. I very proud of myself to say it didn't.
You reined it in.
It didn't, but I remember that feeling of just like doing all this research and being ready to abandon logic for this discounted price. Like,
yep.
Like just yep. without even a, oh. And then I was like, wait, I should at least read the reviews on this, since I spent so much time on this other one. And the reviews yep. were horrible. And I was like, I almost bought that.
Yeah. But like, that's a great example of how we are mental misers, right? We do the least amount of thinking possible, and our brains are very subject to cognitive illusions, and pricing is a big cognitive illusion.
So yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Are you okay? So how did you come to this? Like, how did you decide, I'm really passionate about branding and science, and like, I want to tell people how this works together. Like, how did that come about?
When I was 4 years old and my daddy gave me the Sears Roebuck catalog, I knew my path in life. No, I'm just kidding. I came to this late. I actually studied culture and politics and identity in college. And then in graduate school, I went to graduate school and I studied ecology and urban ecosystems and complexity, and got heady and sciencey, and then jumped ship to work with a high school friend. And we ran a magazine for a couple of years and we ran it right into the ground. So we realized we weren't ready to be business people yet. And at that point, I cast around and found a couple folks here in Boulder where I was living. I just bought a house, so I figured I should stay, who were doing market research. And I got into market research and found it was a good fit. I had been a bit of a journalist. I knew qualitative techniques from my undergrad. I knew quantitative techniques from my graduate studies. So I could do market research around the world. And if they needed qual, I could interview people well. And if they needed quant, I could design and analyze a survey or whatever else data, whatever other data they had. And then from there, one of my clients tapped me and said, "Hey, I'm looking for a strategist for my agency." And I said, "I don't know anyone." And he looked at me again and said, "Ethan, no. I'm looking, wink, wink, for a strategist, nudge, wink, nudge, wink." I said, me. So I joined him and I realized, oh, you're pointing at me. You're not looking at the guy over my shoulder at the other end of the bar. And so I got into advertising as a strategist and I did that for about 15 years. And while I did it, I was baffled by how little science there was. I was like, well, what are the rules? What are the scientific laws? And people had all kinds of theories, all kinds of ideas. Half the time they were either in complete opposition to each other or in complete opposition to the data. So I didn't know what the hell was going on, which led me on this path to try and find some terra firma, some bedrock about how shoppers shop, because it all starts with the shoppers, mm-hmm. how brands grow then, because brands provide that, and then how advertising works. And in the past 20 years, I've found some terra firma, some bedrock to stand on that explains these things in a scientific way. And so here I am now. I'm kind of like Bill Nye, the brand guy.
I like that. Bill Nye, the brand guy. but I think it's even with the headshot strategist that I started off, that's kind of how it kind of developed. It was like, there's certain principles that attract people to images. You know, actors use it all the time. Why aren't business people using it? And it, you know, it's same, like there's laws. Like if I drop something, it's going to fall. It's called gravity. No matter what I do, it is always going to happen. You know, that's right. It's no matter what, it's going to happen. And
but wait, why do feathers fall slower than marbles? What's that about, Peggy? And then people think gravity doesn't apply. But then you find out, oh, gravity does apply. It's this thing called the atmosphere and air resistance. Or they say, but wait, things fall slower on the moon than they do on the Earth. Gravity doesn't apply. And you say, oh, gravity still applies. It's just part of the law that on a smaller planet, a smaller object, things are attracted less. Right. So people think that if they find a difference that or an exception, that the law doesn't apply at all.
And I think, you know, there's a law. If you plant a seed in good ground, it's going to grow. But there is not a law that says you have to harvest that growth. Mm-hmm. That's the lever. I think the law is if you plant it, it's going to grow. The lever is go harvest it.
Yeah.
What
that's
tools
a great
are
way
you
going to
use
it.
To harvest that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in my case, the laws are, again, things that apply to all brands, whether you're a car company, a photographer, you sell toilet paper or shoes. And then the levers are things that may or may not work for different brands. And the classic way to categorize the levers is what's called the marketing mix, the four Ps, the product, which includes packaging, the price, the place, which is your distribution, and the promotion, which is all the advertising and PR and hoopla that we do to try and get the word out. And you can pull those in different ways. So pricing is a great lever to pull to change how well your business does. And as you said, sometimes you jack up your price and demand goes up. You know who else learned that, Peggy, besides you, was small liberal arts colleges in the East Coast. Let's say you're Franklin and Marshall or Dickinson. I don't know if you've heard of them, but small schools that mostly attract local kids. And they were moderately competitive, but not great. And then a couple of them realized if they jacked up their prices 15 or 20%, people thought they were a more elite, prestigious school, and their enrollment went way up. And that's because it's a lever they decided to pull. Mm-hmm. Does it work every time? No. Did it work in that case? Yes. Similarly, here's another lever you can pull. You can kill your mascot. I know, a little extreme. And of course, it means you have to start with a mascot. But I don't know if you recall a few years ago around the Super Bowl, Planters Nuts killed Mr. Peanut.
I remember him being all bandaged up with a cane and
yeah, it was a fiery car crash with like Wesley Snipes or something like
that.
Wow. And then he was reborn actually during the Super Bowl. So they killed him just prior. And then they brought him back during the Super Bowl. I think it was the High C man's, no, the Kool-Aid man's tears. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, the Kool-Aid man.
Right.
He cried. And his tears made the little baby nut grow. And so baby nut was born. So for the first time in, I don't know, 50 years, people were actually talking about Planters and Mr. Peanut. So it quickly revived the brand in people's minds. It died off pretty quickly because you can't do that over and over and over.
Right.
But there was nothing in the data that said, you know what we should do to gain some notoriety and bring Planters back into the fore?
Let's kill
our mascot.
That's pretty aggressive.
Yeah.
That is pretty aggressive. That's pretty funny, but sometimes it has to be, and that's the art part of it, right? That's somebody woke up at 3 a.m. and went, you know what? I always wake up at 3 a.m. with ideas. So I assume most brilliant people wake up at 3 a.m. with ideas. I don't know if that's factual or not, but in my world, if you have a brilliant idea, it came to you around 3 a.m. They woke up, they were like, you know, what would happen if we like killed him off? Everybody was talking about it. And then, you know, who else we haven't, like, let's team up with Kool-Aid, because like we haven't seen Kool-Aid guy like burst through a wall in a few decades. So let's bring that back. Let's have him cry and resurrect our mascot. Let's see. Yeah. Let's do that.
Yeah. That sounds great. Right. That sounds really smart and logical, right? That's the other challenge, especially when you get to some of these creative levers, and not even the creative ones, the pricing ones, is that they come across as illogical and irrational. And a lot of people in business fancy themselves very logical and very rational. So it's often very hard to A, believe that these things will work at all, and then B, to sell them in to the rest of the team who are logical and rational and hard-nosed. I think at that point, Planters had probably started to realize they need to do something because no one's ever talking about Planters and they need to do something kind of drastic. I think VaynerMedia was the group that helped do that. And Gary Vaynerchuk is kind of a celebrity.
Yeah.
So he can probably come in and sell anything. So there are other factors at play. It absolutely got them notoriety. I'm sure it boosted sales for a while. I would think that they would want to continue to build momentum. But again, it's not right for every brand. It might not work again. It might not have worked that time. But it's an illogical seeming thing that is probably something that could work for a brand in the right situation.
In the right situation. Yeah. So yeah. Another thing that you mentioned was like how we pull, like when we're looking at stats and how we pull numbers and how many people are in that pool. Because I know for me, I'm like, I don't feel like I'm represented in the stats. Like I can see the stats and I'm like, but those stats really don't apply to me. So what if I don't do what the stats say? What if I do what I would, you know, how I would consume, like, you know, so you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, there is absolutely a big fallacy in marketing to believe that you are the consumer. That's actually how most brands or most companies start. People become entrepreneurs because they're like, I need this.
Right.
I want something, right? I want an insulated dog bowl that also folds down so I can go hiking with it. And therefore, I think everyone else will too. And so there's this assumption that I am my consumer. So the first thing you have to do is really get out there and see the world and talk to the world and look at the data. And the data can be qualitative data, or as one woman calls it, thick data, which I love. And the data can be quantitative, which is sometimes big data, but sometimes not. Sometimes it's just a small quant study. But you need to actually go check out whether your intuition or your behavior is normal or common or prevalent. I do an exercise, I think you saw it in the South by Southwest talk, where I talk about genes, because we have a belief in most marketing circles that the pinnacle of brand success is brand loyalty, amazing brand loyalty with fanatical fans. And a classic example of that would be people, how much they love Levi's and the Levi's 501, and that there are brand loyalists and that's what they love. And I invariably ask a group of people, first of all, is there anyone here that loves a brand? And someone always says yes. And if it's a guy, usually he loves Levi's. And he's like, I only buy Levi's. And then I turn to the whole group and I say, so raise your hand if you have more than one brand of jeans in your closet. And all the other hands go up. And the guy looks around and realizes he's the freak of nature. He is not normal. And I say this with love because we all do this, mm-hmm. right? We all say, well, I only ever buy, in my case, diamond kosher salt because I love the exact way the little crystals are formed. And I'm big on kosher salt ever since I saw some TV show. And therefore, that's brand loyalty. But then I realize, oh, yeah, I don't buy any other diamond products. And I don't care what peppercorns I get for my pepper shaker. And I don't care what brand of spices I buy, Penzies or Savoy. I don't even know the name of the brand. McCormick. I think it's McCormick. It's not McKinsey. Wouldn't it be great if McKinsey made spices? But that's where you need to check your behavior to the world. And a little bit of data is really helpful to make sure you're not just assuming that how you are is how the world is. And especially for your own brand or product or category, because we think about it all the time. I'm about to post about this tomorrow. Other people don't think about our stuff all the time. I mean, I'll bet you do photography and headshots. That takes at most 0.5% of someone's week to do that with you, and therefore a 1/1000th of a percent of their year.
No, I think they think about me a lot more than that.
Well, they send you whiskey. So there is love. There is love.
But you're right. And that's kind of a hard truth. And what I learned from your video on that is there are people that own 16 pairs of blue jeans. But back on track.
Well, we all have our thing, Peggy. We all have something where we're like, oh, I'm a little embarrassed to say how into this category.
I would probably, you know, as I look around my house and I have cameras, like cameras that are working and cameras that are not working, literally all over.
Yeah.
I've never taken a count. I probably should not take a count.
You're like Leica, Hasselblad, Minolta.
All over. Oh, I even have Canon sitting around. Like, I mean, there is nothing that you know.
I have a daguerreotype machine in my garage. Yeah, you're a freak like that. But but Peggy, you also said a thing I want to grab onto, which is you said it's a hard truth that people don't think about you or your brand or your category much. And it is at first a hard truth, especially if you come from a world where you buy the mythology of brand love and brand loyalty. But then it's so freeing. It's I think it was Eleanor Roosevelt who said something like, "Darling, you would care a lot less about what people think of you if only you knew how little they think of you at all." And so you're free. You're free to have fun and to do fun things and to do more exorbitant and extravagant things to get any kind of attention whatsoever. You're free to be more you, more yourself, and realize that the first thing is just at least to go from 0.001% to 0.004%. And then you're going to crush it because everyone else in your category is still at 0.001%.
That's kind of mind blowing, to be honest with you. That is freeing because we do think, I think that, okay, I got to be careful because people know that I always do this and people know that people probably don't know that I even post, you know, they don't even know how often I post or where I post, let alone what, you know, they don't.
Hey, hold up that shirt again. Absolutely. The shirt I sent.
Hold on.
Okay. The Science AF shirt. It's a little bit of a pumpkin kind of orange.
Yeah.
I'd say.
I almost wore it, but I was like, no, I'll hold it up so people can see it better.
That's great. I'm wearing a jersey, the Netherlands Dutch national team jersey, which I wear all the time. This is more of a bright, not quite neon orange. I've got my business cards, which are a slightly different reddish orange. Yeah, my chocolate, the wrapper.
Mm,
I don't know what color orange that is.
Science is tasty.
Tasty chocolate. Tasty, tasty science chocolate. None of my oranges match. And as a brand guy, I would be mortified, especially for a big brand like Starbucks. And they do have to watch out that they don't want to come across as neon green and then forest green and then also like Kelly green. But come on, for me, no one's thinking about me. It doesn't matter if my oranges don't match. I'm amazed that they connect me with orange at all. So there is a freedom, right, to this notion, the truth that most people don't think about you because they're worried about their kids and their jobs and their health problems and all the other stuff that really matters.
All right, I'm going to tell myself because you brought this up, and it is true. Now I see how ridiculous this is, so I'm going to say it. I'm going to tell. So my Headshots by Peggy logo is blue, like my branding. I'm blue, but a few years ago I updated my logo and I put an orange stripe in my camera logo. The reason is I'm a Sony shooter and, you know, I wanted to, and Sony lenses have that orange stripe on them. And without saying I'm a Sony, I just wanted to see who would catch it. It was more of a like experience to see who would catch on to my little subtle like thing. And then when I started, you know, expanding from my clients being headshot clients to doing, you know, working with photographers, I was like, okay, any orange I use, I'm going to make sure it's that same orange. And at some point I had made a whole bunch of things. And then I realized I was using the wrong orange and it was so slight. I'm probably the only one that even noticed. And I went and redid all of the logos on everything just so this little barely little sliver of orange matched. And now saying it out loud, like I probably spent hours on that. It seems really silly now to say it out loud. Because I doubt that anybody, A, even noticed my orange, or B, noticed that they were too different. So yeah, the things we get hung up on because we think that people are watching us with a microscope and to realize that people don't care.
I also want to thank you for your vulnerability. I think that it's you know, that's the bravest thing you can do, as Brené Brown would say, right? Is be vulnerable and share with us your kooky obsession about Canon orange or Sony, whoever
Sony,
it is.
Sony
orange. See, I'm outside the category. I can't tell.
It's all right.
Are there bears on Sony or do they have babies on Sony?
Right. I'm just kidding. Right. I use Kirkland myself. So we don't have any cool mascots, but
yeah.
But yes, it is so, that is a freeing thing. And And why did I spend hours on worrying about if my logos all matched that specific orange versus going out and DMing and building relationships with somebody?
Sure. That's what I find is so valuable about learning the laws and the levers. And I'm working on my book, and I think I might even have a third section, but it would be too big. The laws and levers, and then the BS, the crap. Because there are things that are brand laws, and people confuse that all the time. For instance, they think that brand purpose is a law, that you need to have brand purpose to sell mayonnaise. Turns out you don't. Spoiler alert. Secondly, there are the levers, and you need to know how they work and the difference between the laws and the levers. And then third, there's just stuff that absolutely doesn't matter or doesn't work. To understand those three things and to understand them intuitively, but also functionally, allows people to be so much more effective and therefore also efficient with their marketing and advertising and how they can grow their business. So I have a lot of fun doing it, but I see that the impact is really significant because it makes you a much more effective and efficient marketer.
Absolutely. I love talking to you. I literally get my mind blown every time that we have a conversation. So even though you have already given like a bazillion gems here, what is your one final tip that you want to leave our listeners with today?
One final tip. Well, you said it. This is about awareness this month. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's make sure we hit on that. And I think we have started to with Eleanor Roosevelt that people are probably just unaware of you. That's usually the most important first step, is to realize not what they're saying about you, but that they're not saying anything about you. And this happens for big brands too. So awareness, or any kind of salience, you could call it, any kind of stickiness, is your first step. And to do that takes a whole lot of creativity, a whole lot of persistence, sometimes a whole lot of consistency. Like if you want coffee and you see a green and white sign, and you know it's going to be Starbucks probably. But it also takes a lot of being interesting, because if you're boring and bland and dull, you're just wallpaper and no one's going to notice you at all. So it's, again, a hard truth that most of what we do in marketing is boring and bland and dull and a waste of money. But it's a freeing truth, because it means you should give yourself permission to be more interesting, to be more yourself, to be more out there and grab the attention so that you can raise awareness.
Wow.
It's like therapy.
It is. It's therapy. We should call this brand therapy. Because it is.
Well, now you can call me Dr. Decker.
Thank you for the therapy session, Dr. Decker.
If I'm a TV therapist and I don't have an MD, then it's definitely Dr. Ethan, not Dr. Decker. Yes. Hi. Welcome to the Dr. Ethan Show. Today, our guest is Peggy.
And we're talking about how she actually believes people give a crap about her brand.
She got a little too hung up on the tone of orange. That was a microscopic tone on her. Yeah.
That is so awesome. Well, I have thoroughly enjoyed this, and I know everyone else listening has too. Thank you so, so much for taking the time to hang out with us. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. My pleasure as well. Thanks for having me.
And we'll be bringing you back.
Excellent.
All right. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.